Hello and welcome to A History of the United States, episode 169, The Cause of and Solution to All of Life's Problems. Last time out, we looked at Hamilton's financial plan, how he planned to use credit, the national bank, a national mint, and manufacturing to increase the wealth of the United States. The economic aspects of Hamilton's financial plan were obviously very significant, but the politics of it were also important too. We finished by looking at the threats the young republic was facing, both external, with the British and Spanish lurking on the northern and southern frontiers respectively. We also talked on the potential for internal problems, such as the threat of a repeat of Shays' Rebellion, and this is where we turn our attention to today, the Whiskey Rebellion. To see its origins, I'd like to focus on three threads, which would tie themselves together: excise taxes, the westward migration, and the frontier economy. Like much of early American history, the Whiskey Rebellion has its origins in Britain and British political culture. Traditionally, most taxation occurred either in the form of duties and tariffs at the port of entry for goods from abroad, or on land. There was a lot of opposition to internal taxes, specifically excise taxes. An excise tax is something different. It's a tax on specific goods or services at purchase. Usually the tax is paid by the producer and then passed on indirectly to the customer. The Crown attempted to impose excise taxes in 1626, but Parliament resisted, eventually raising its own excise taxes in 1643 during the Civil War on beer, ale, cider, and perry, followed by salt, beef, rabbits, and pigeons the next year. There was a great deal of opposition, particularly in areas outside of London, but Parliament persisted. It was one of the great political fights throughout the 17th and 18th centuries in Britain. I won't go into all the details, but suffice it to say, this carried over to the United States. Our second thread, which we've touched on from time to time and will soon focus on in more detail, is the effects that were happening from the westward migration. People living on the frontiers were resentful of the power imbalance, with so much power belonging to the East. It had deep roots in American history. You could go as far back as the early episodes in our series to Bacon's Rebellion, looking for an example of it. This was also, you'll remember, one of the contributing factors to Shays' Rebellion. The farmers of Western Massachusetts did not believe that the assemblymen in Boston were making decisions for their benefit, only for those of the Eastern merchants. This was playing out across the whole frontier. Many thought that the solution to this would be peaceful and that the West would soon gained states of its own that would give them power within the Federation. But others saw only a violent end, with the West becoming independent. These were differences that the British in the North and the Spanish in the South sought to exploit. Pleas for autonomy, independence, and statehood went back to the Revolution, but gradually grew stronger throughout the 1770s and 1780s. By the late 1780s, there were fears that either Kentucky or Western Pennsylvania would attempt to secede from the Union. We now turn to the third and final threat, the frontier economy. Life on the frontier was hard. Those six words will be one of the great themes of this podcast. I may take several hundred episodes for the magnitude of them to fully sink in, as we explore just how brutal the next century will be. But it's a theme right there from the beginning. Life on the frontier was hard. There will be myths of a classless frontier society, but that never existed. Life on the frontier was hard, and always would be. But to focus in on the specifics of the West in the 1780s and 1790s, the West was isolated. It was quite an ironic situation, really. The area contained some of the best agricultural land in North America. It was near some of the best game land in North America. It was also extremely well connected. Pittsburgh sits at the confluence of the Allegheny and Monongahela rivers, which form the Ohio, which then goes into the Mississippi. Yet, with the Spanish controlling the lower Mississippi, it left the area isolated, with much difficult terrain separating it from the established settlements on the coast. The winters were also brutal. It did not make for an egalitarian society. By 1780, approximately one-third of the population of Western Pennsylvania townships was without land, a figure that rose to 60% over the next 15 years. Meanwhile, those at the top of the socioeconomic pyramid increased their land holdings, and most of these were outsiders. Over the 1790s, residential landowners struggled at the expense of Eastern speculators. This was combined with significant immigration. Between 1770 and 1800, the population of Western Pennsylvania increased from around 5,000 to over 90,000. But the growth wasn't continuous, experiencing massive bursts in the early 1770s and the mid-1780s. What you can see here is a society in extreme turmoil. Land and wealth were being concentrated in fewer and fewer hands, while most struggled to find any land at all, and people kept coming. The new arrivals expected there to be land available for them to own a farm and start a brand new life. Instead, they found themselves sharecropping, working someone else's land and paying a share of the crop as rent, and living in cabins with mud floors and no chimneys. John May, a wealthy Massachusetts merchant, was interested in investing in land in Ohio, and so made a trip there on behalf of the Ohio Company. He had many interesting things to say about the area, and his stay in Pittsburgh in particular makes clear just how deeply unpleasant he found parts of the frontier life. The line, "This confusion crazes me," just about sums it up. But he makes an interesting comment, quote, "Money affairs here are at a low ebb. Everybody unwilling to part with money, but very anxious to get it," end quote. Lack of hard money will be a big issue affecting the United States, as we've talked about extensively with Hamilton's financial plans, and it was particularly an issue on the frontier. He also makes reference to the threat of Indians, writing that when he was at Marietta, quote, "Thursday, May 29th. This day, the axe is laid to root the trees. Find the soil, very good, but was tormented beyond measure by myriads of gnats. They not only bit surprisingly, but get down one's throat. This evening, arrived two longboats from the rapids with officers and soldiers, the number about 100. On their passage up the river, they were fired upon by a strong party of Indians, headed by a white man. They returned fire and had two men killed. They were obliged to drop down the river apiece and come by the place in the night. There are various reports about the hostilities of the savages, but nothing to be depended on. The Indians are frequently in here and seem to be on friendly terms. I've shaken hands with many of them. Tuesday, July 1st. We were alarmed today by a letter from Major Dowsey at Pittsburgh, stating that they had just received intelligence from Detroit that two parties of Indian warriors, about 40 in each party, were started on a hostile expedition against our settlement and Kentucky. Our people were called in from labor at 11 o'clock, and a guard consisting of a subaltern and 30 men sent to reconnoiter and scour the woods. They took a day's provisions with them." End quote. So let's evaluate what we have here. A very unhappy society. People were poor, living in poverty and squalor. They were resentful that they had been sold a life different to the hell they were living. They were scared from the constant threat of Indian attack. They felt they were on their own, abandoned by the government, which was focused on the Atlantic seaboard. They had great agricultural land for growing things, but didn't have the infrastructure to be able to store it or move it anywhere to sell. They were short on money and were looking for something which could provide. Really, there was only one thing they were going to turn to. The cause of, and solution to, all of life's problems. Whiskey. It was non-perishable, there was a market for it, It would warm people in the cold and help them bear their hardships. And this is where we tie our threads together. In 1783, Pennsylvania began an excise tax on whiskey. This met with immediate opposition from the Westerners. Some of this came from a place resentful of central control. They wanted freedom to trade as they wished and fight Indians as they wished. But part of the resistance came from people who wished to meaningfully engage with the government. It was just that a whiskey excise tax was unjust. As we said at the beginning, an excise tax is intended to be on a good or service, usually paid at the point of production, but with the costs passed on to the consumer, so the customer pays it indirectly. This is how excises on alcohol work today. However, in the West in the 1780s, whiskey wasn't being sold for profit. As John May said, there was very little money around. It was primarily being produced as a form of currency to pay agricultural labourers. Selling it was secondary. They were doing this because they didn't have cash. So they were being asked to pay a tax in cash for the production of whiskey, which they were producing because they didn't have any cash. The whole thing didn't make any sense. And they were right. It didn't. So, after many petitions, Pennsylvania finally saw sense and repealed the whiskey excise tax. The frontiersmen saw this as a great victory. They had defeated big governments. They saw that their tactics had worked. This had involved petitions to the government, refusal to pay, and even a tax on the excise collectors. There is a particularly notable example from 1786, when William Graham, a state excise officer, was attacked in Washington County. A crowd in blackface attacked him, took his pistols, destroyed them, tore up his documents, made him stomp on them, and then cursed both the documents and the politicians who sent him. They cut the hair on half his head, cut a hole in his hat, and did similar things to his horse, then marched him around the frontier counties, stopping off at each distillery for a ceremony he had to participate in. The lesson learnt on the frontier was that all this was good. This was why they had won. Really, there were other factors at play. The politicians in the East didn't understand or care about the concerns of the frontiersmen. They knew that excise taxes were unpopular and were difficult and unprofitable to collect. It simply wasn't worth the effort to them, particularly when the federal government was considering raising its own excise taxes. If somebody was going to waste their time trying to collect taxes from frontiersmen, let it be federal officials rather than state officials. Next time, we'll see what happens when they try. Thanks for listening. I'll see you then.